Mr. Burnett.
Your Honor, this case deals with an insurance coverage dispute. Krieger International is a furniture company in Green Bay, Wisconsin. At the end of 2004, executives sought to depart the company, and they went to the company's chief financial officer, a gentleman named Mark Olson, asked, if we quit our jobs, if we retire before the end of the year, how does that affect the amount of money we will get for the stock that we happen to own in the company? Mr. Olson, the chief financial officer, said, well, if you quit before the end of the year, you will get the value of your stock as determined by the third quarter of the year 2000. If you quit in the first quarter of 2001, then you will get the December 2000 value, the fourth quarter value of the stock. In this particular situation, that was a considerable amount of money, about $4 million. So the employees resigned in the year 2000 before the end of the year. In actuality, that advice proved to be wrong. The shareholders' agreement gave the board the prerogative to call the stock over a 90-day period so they could time the call and therefore set the purchase price. The employees sued in state court in Wisconsin. Shareholders sued in state court in Wisconsin, and that resulted in a jury verdict that decided two things. First of all, did Mr. Olson modify the contract between the parties orally? And second, did he have apparent authority to do that? At trial, Mr. Olson denied giving that advice and making those statements, but the jury found against him. After the verdict, the KI proceeded through the Wisconsin appellate courts and unsuccessfully. After the verdict, the verdict was tendered to an insurance company, Royal Insurance, which issued employee liability insurance coverage, a new type of insurance. They had been defending the case under a reservation of rights. They denied coverage. They said in their denial letter, we acknowledge that a claim has been made for an employment wrongful act, two key terms in the policy, but we don't believe that a loss has occurred. So the issue before this court is two issues. First of all, is there a loss that occurred? And second, did KI commit an employment wrongful act? There are two collateral policy defenses, one dealing with employment benefits and one dealing with a written breach of a written contract exclusion, which I'll address as well. In reviewing briefing, it does not appear.
You know, the Wisconsin Intermediate Court found that board acquiesced in Olson's action, ratified it.
I think they had found that on previous occasions the board had acquiesced and had ratified Olson's conduct. In this particular case, the board repudiated Olson's conduct, called this.
Sure, it changed its mind later, but what the court said was Krueger's own evidence suggests the board merely served as a rubber stamp after the fact for stock redemption transactions effectuated by Olson. That would actually give Olson actual authority. I mean, sure, the board, you know, when they see it's going to cost them $5 million, they change their mind rapidly. But even though the case is discussed as an apparent authority case, looks as if the court thought that Olson had actual authority.
Actually, no, Your Honor. Two points. First of all, factually, although I didn't try the case below, I am familiar with the record. Factually, there is no evidence that the board knew that Olson was calling the stock in the fourth quarter to pay third quarter value.
You didn't have to know that.
Well,
if you authorize an employee to do something, you don't have to have knowledge of what he does. The only question is whether it's within the scope of his authority. And if, as the appellate court is suggesting here, the board had given Olson carte blanche to, you know, make deals with these departing shareholders, then he had actual authority.
No, and actually the second point is the more important point, and that is that the circuit judge here found, and it's in a passage cited in my brief, and I can put my finger on it in a minute or two if I need to, the circuit court actually found there is no claim here that Olson had actual authority.
There's a muddle here about the meaning of actual authority. And if you look at the preceding page, I was looking at page 185 of the appendix. But if you look at 184, you see that after defining the elements of apparent authority, they state as an issue what Krueger knows, you know, what Krueger knew about what Olson's practices. Well, that is an actual authority inquiry, right?
I would agree that the Court of Appeals...
Krueger argues that the board did not know of Olson's representations and did not acquiesce in them. Well, that sounds as if it's an issue whether there was actual authority, because for apparent authority, acquiescence would be irrelevant.
That's right, and I would agree that as the Court of Appeals has discussed the case, they have vacillated between concepts of actual authority and concepts of apparent authority. But what's important is not what the Court of Appeals determined, because they don't find facts. What's important is what the jury found, because they do find facts, and this insurance policy covers liability. The liability they cover is the judgment that issued out of the Circuit Court for Brown County, Wisconsin. So the fact that the Court of Appeals may have confused actual and apparent authority doesn't change the fact that the circuit judge said actual authority is not part of this case, and that if you read the Court of Appeals decision in context, they are talking about what the board had done in the past to clothe Olson with vestiges of authority that would lead anyone dealing with him to believe he had authority to say what he said.
But the jury's verdict is a real problem for you insofar as this coverage claim, though, because it's binding on us, and the jury characterized what went on here as a contract modification made with some sort of authority, whatever the legal resolution of that is, but as a factual matter, made with authority. And we are not at liberty to reconstrue this as some sort of a misrepresentation for purposes of finding coverage. We're stuck with the characterization of the jury verdict of the facts here, which is that this is a contract modification, not any sort of a misrepresentation or misstatement.
It's a contract modification based on the verdict language that was found, but it is based on a misstatement of fact, an error, a breach of duty, an act or an omission.
But look, you're going in two directions, because in answer to me you said, well, we just look at what the jury determined. But in answer to Judge Sykes, you're suggesting let's go beyond this language contract modification and see what's really involved.
No,
your notion is what's really involved here, this is really an estoppel case. This is, you know, the Olson gets steps out of line, but because of his authority, his apparent authority, the company is estopped to deny that he could bind it. That's the way you want to characterize it. But the language of contract modification, as Judge Sykes points out, if we stop right there, that's fatal for you, right? Because you don't because the insurance is not against breach of contract.
Well, the insurance does cover breaches of contract.
It can't cover breaches of contract, right? Otherwise, you just write a contract and you say, well, I'm not going to perform this contract because if I'm sued, the insurance company pays.
If we go, and I'm not sure I've answered Judge Sykes' question yet, but if we go to the insuring clause and if we go to the policy definitions, this is the type of thing this policy covers. Any error, misstatement, misleading statement, act, omission, neglect breach of duty actually committed, including but not limited to wrongful dismissal, discharge, termination of employment, breach of any oral or written employment contract or quasi-employment contract.
This is not an employment contract.
No, this is not an employment contract, but my point, Your Honor, is that this policy covers intentional misconduct.
If it says breach of employment contract, there's no implication that it covers other contracts. In fact, the implication is the opposite. It doesn't say any breach of contract.
This does not cover breach of all contracts, except if they fall in the category of wrongful dismissal, discharge, termination, employment-related misrepresentations.
None of which is involved here.
Well, I think an employment-related misrepresentation is very much involved.
Didn't find a misrepresentation.
The jury found a modification.
Well, that gets back to Judge Sykes. So why don't you, if you didn't think you'd answer Judge Sykes, why don't you do that?
Let me restate the question, Judge, and you tell me if I've got it right. Your question is this court bound solely and exclusively by the jury's verdict? And if so, how does the finding that there's been a modification of a contract somehow or other give rise to coverage?
Yes.
Thank you. Judge Posner said that I'm having it both ways. I'm not having it both ways in the sense that I'm saying that what binds this court is what happened at the Brown County Circuit Court level. The Court of Appeals doesn't find facts, and its characterization of what happened below may be informational, but isn't binding. Having said that, this is a case that a court needs to look at the summary judgment record here, developed here, where the case came on cross motions for summary judgment, and examine that record and to discern what is it in there that could give rise to coverage here. The undisputed fact involves what Olson said. He said to these employees, if you quit early, you will get more money for your stock. Is that an employment-related misrepresentation?
But the case wasn't submitted to the jury on a misrepresentation theory.
No,
that was dismissed on summary judgment, as I understand it. So the jury didn't find that a misrepresentation had been made. The jury found that a contract modification had been entered into with authority, and I think the third question was damages, and that was it.
Maybe I should take a step back and say I don't read the term misrepresentation in the legal tort sense. This policy is construed according to the average policyholder's understanding. If you say to the man on the street, what does a misrepresentation mean? He will say it's a false statement. He won't say it's a false statement sounding in tort, giving rise to a certain
category
of damage.
It's not a false statement if he has authority to modify the contract.
He doesn't have authority to modify the contract. That's
why the contract got modified.
The contract got modified because he had apparent authority to modify the contract. And that's what the case was tried on. The circuit court, as I indicated earlier, said this is not a case about actual authority. Olson lacked actual authority. The plaintiffs never claimed he had it.
This is not an injury to the departed employee, which is normally what I think would be covered here. You're going after Olson. Basically, you want us to say that Olson committed a wrongful act, and therefore Royal has to, I guess, indemnify the company because of his wrongful act.
This is a case about reading an insurance policy and applying the words that the insurance company wrote.
Aren't they all though directed at employee, those that detrimentally relied or didn't detrimentally rely on what Olson did, as opposed to Olson? What he did to the company.
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, I guess when you read that, it's mostly all of them are focused on what would be an injured employee if the company did something to it.
No, this policy is a very peculiar policy, and the insuring clause is at the center of it. It's at page 162 of the appendix. And what this policy says is we cover the insured's loss. It is KI's loss that they cover. First made for claims from claims, first made during the policy period, so there's got to be a claim, and it's claim made policy, against the insureds for employment wrongful acts. So there's two steps. First of all, is there a claim for an employment wrongful act? Did the plaintiff say Olson made certain misrepresentations, misstatements? They certainly did if you go to the state court complaint. And then the second...
Well, I think what Judge Mannion is asking about, the wrong is to the corporation. It's not into an employee, right?
Yes, but the policy...
They're promising them the moon. They're delighted, right, the employees?
But the policy covers KI's loss, and the insurance clause requires that the loss, quote, result from the claim. So if we have a claim made for Olson's mistake that results in a loss, there is coverage.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Burnett. Mr. Reed?
May it please the court. I've heard three themes in the court's questioning, and I think all three themes are basically the essence of our argument, that there is no loss that occurred caused by an employment wrongful act for several reasons. First, as Judge Posner's questions indicated, what really caused any loss to the employees was that the board changed its mind when it saw the sinking stock price in the fourth quarter of 2000. That is not an employment wrongful act. That is not a misrepresentation. The second reason, which I picked up through Judge Sykes' questions, was that we are bound, as we have to be, by the state court's determination of all issues, and that there was no misrepresentation claim submitted to the jury that was not involved in the verdict. Originally, there was a negligent misrepresentation claim in the underlying suit. That was dismissed on a summary judgment, and the only thing that was submitted to the jury was a breach of contract claim. So we are left with, and we are bound by, the state court's verdict because, again, we don't have a duty to defend issue here. My client stepped up, defended this case through all levels of the Wisconsin court system. We've paid for all those defense costs, and that's simply not at issue. The question is, do we have to pay for the additional costs that Mr. Burnett's client incurred in connection with that judgment? And I think both because it's not caused by any employment wrongful act and because there was no finding of a misrepresentation.
Well, is Mr. Burnett correct that this is a very unusual insurance policy?
No, it really isn't, Your Honor. It's a type of policy that really got its legs in the mid-90s, perhaps even a little bit earlier than that, and was designed to meet the rising tide of employment cases that obviously this court is familiar with. But that is typically performed on a wrongful act. It's covered on a wrongful act basis.
So are you the only company that writes these?
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor. It is a very well-recognized. The one thing is that there isn't an awful lot of a body of case law developed on the coverage issues on the employment practices side. I've litigated a number of them myself throughout the country, but it's something that we don't have the body of case law as we do in the general liability context. It really is often sold as a package with other policies, typically with directors and officers coverage.
I was wondering about that. Yeah.
That's very typical. Sometimes it's paired with other packages. Errors and omissions, for example, if you're a bank, you might get banker's professional liability, E&O, D&O. So the coverage is out there. It's a fairly standard coverage, but as I say, for those of us who litigate coverage issues under that, there haven't been a lot of cases that have made it to the published opinion stage yet. So we're relying a bit on the D&O cases, and even to some extent, some of the fiduciary liability authorities, such as this court's decisions in May Department Stores or Baylor Heating, to address the loss causation
have
issue.
Have you written them a D&O policy? Do you know?
I believe this was a standalone, Your Honor.
Hypothetically, wouldn't they have a potential a claim under such a policy? That is, didn't Olson, exceed his authority and cause harm to the company or something? Or maybe the directors caused harm to the company by having, let him do anything he wanted.
Well, it's possible that some harm was caused to the company, but this is picking up on my third point here, which relates to Judge Mannion's questions. This is really a third-party liability policy. And so to the extent that a wrongful act is defined in the policy causes injury to the employees, then that is arguably compensable. The alleged wrongful act here, when the case was first filed and included the negligent misrepresentation count, that wrongful act didn't harm anyone because if it had been honored by the board and had followed its past practice in the 35 to 40 cases previously involving redemptions, they would have been made whole. They would not have suffered any harm. So I don't think that that's covered under this policy. Is there a possibility that this act could have been covered under, let's say, a D&O policy? Potentially it could, but that's really not an issue.
I understand it's not an issue. I'm just curious.
But it's an interesting question. I do think that Judge Mannion's comments about there being no loss to the employees, which is another point that Judge Griesbach decided in his opinion. And I think the whole point that we'd like to make here is that I didn't see anything in the brief of the appellant or the reply brief, or I didn't hear anything in the argument that suggests that the district court in any way misrepresented or mischaracterized or even overlooked a critical controlling authority. I think this court's past precedents on this type of issue are highly understandable. They're broad determinations of law, and I think clearly what caused any loss to anyone here was when Krieger's board elected not to uphold the decision that Mr. Olson made, and that's simply not a covered loss.
Well, of course, that was the loss to, that was a potential cost to these individuals who were leaving. But I think his basic argument is that the policy doesn't exclude the possibility of a harm to the corporation, although I'm sure you're right. You know, the basic idea is to protect against this third-party liability, but it doesn't quite exclude it. And that what's really going on here is that Olson overstepped the bounds. He bound the company because he had apparent authority, but he was acting outside his actual authority. So that's a kind of like a tort committed against the company.
In a sense, Your Honor, but I think as the court pointed out in the May Department Stores matter, this would basically be the functional equivalent of, let's say, a purchasing manager electing to buy a fleet of Fords rather than a fleet of Chevys, and his supervisor or the board says, "No, I didn't want the Fords. I wanted the Chevys," and therefore turning that mistaken interpretation of his duties or contract into a compensable loss. And that's really not what third-party liability insurance is about. And I think that's what this court's precedents fairly strongly established the proposition for. And really, this court's, in all honesty, one of the leaders throughout the country in establishing that proposition. Those cases are cited frequently, and I think that the district court did the right thing in following them. We did cite a couple of other policy provisions. I don't think the court really needs to get to them. One is a breach of contract exclusion for loss incurred as a result of breach of an express written contract. Clearly, by the time the case went to the jury, the only cause of action that remained was a breach of contract. And even though there was arguably an oral modification of that contract, absent the written contract, there could have been no liability. So I think that provision is very clear. And I think also this case, if it in fact arises out of an employment relationship, and I know that Krieger's counsel disputes that, then the benefits exclusion applied. But on the other hand, if this didn't arise out of an employment relationship, there was no employment-related misrepresentation in the first place.
Well, the Employment Wrongful Act is directed at, in this case, the departed employees, if they were wronged. And I guess that what he wants to focus on is the Employment Wrongful Act by Olson, what they allege is a wrongful act. And you say that might come under some other type of policy. Is that correct? Is that what your reading is? That this Employment Wrongful Act would not include something that Olson did as making a, we'll call it a corporate decision.
Well, it is a corporate. It's a deliberate business decision, and I think since we're stuck with the record of the underlying court, there really wasn't any kind of misrepresentation. Theoretically, could someone have made a case? Could a different finding have been made that might end up triggering whether this insurance coverage or potentially a D&O or some other type of coverage? It is possible. Certainly, we accepted the defense under reservation of rights because we didn't know how the decision was going to be shaped, and now we do. So I hope I've answered the court's question in that respect.
That's enough.
There are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Mr. Burnett, your time has expired, but if you'd like a minute, you may have it.
I'd like to answer Judge Mannion's question, and I think your question, Your Honor, was whether this policy just covers wrongful acts KI did or whether it covers acts of Olson's as well. And the answer to that is found at page 165 of the appendix in the definition of employment wrongful acts. It says
160 what?
165. It says it means any error, and I'll skip all the rest, allegedly committed or attempted by the company or one or more insured persons. Now, if you go to the definition of insured persons, you'll see that they're that includes one or more natural persons who are now or were full or part-time employees of the company. So this policy says we cover what KI does through its board and we cover what KI's employees do. This is not a policy that just talks about the company as a monolithic organization.
So it covers injuries to the company?
It covers a loss to the company that is produced by a claim, which you judge by the state court complaint. There was plainly a claim, and if that makes a claim for an employment wrongful act, and I think it's paragraph 14 and paragraph 18 or 19 of the state court complaint that complains about Olson's statements about the incorrect information he gave. So you have an employment wrongful act giving rise to a claim which ultimately results in a loss. You have coverage.
You have a duty to defend, but not necessarily coverage.
Well,
the coverage depends on, this gets back to my original question, the facts found by the jury, not what was asserted in the complaint. We'd look to that if we were deciding a duty to defend issue.
What I'm quoting from is the insuring clause, and I think what the court needs to do is it needs to look at two things. It needs to look at the jury verdict, the facts the jury found, and it needs to look at those underlying facts that may not be addressed in the jury verdict itself but are undisputed in this record. Thank you.
But they paid your defense, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both of us.